Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Casteros. My name is Christian Corley and he is James McLean. And this is edition 501. And you might be thinking, oh, it's another 500-ish celebration of Casteros' 500th episode. It's not. It's not. No. The thing about 500-ish is we can pop them out anytime, really. That wasn't really the plan, but because something has occurred that we want to talk about, that's what the plan is now. There's still 500-ish stuff coming. There's stuff recorded, etc. So that's ready to go when we get there. But this podcast is about Blake's Seven.
That's the first time I've heard anyone, I don't think in my whole life, I have heard anyone enunciate the possession of the Seven. You know what I mean?
I knew you were going to say that. I absolutely knew that's what you were going to say.
But I think it's crazy, isn't it? Because no one has. I've never heard anyone do it, and I've always found it weird. You know, typographically, even as a kid, I found the possessive apostrophe is really. It's weird to see in a logo because you don't get that in logos. Logos don't tend to have a need for that sort of, I don't know what you call it, grammatical syntax or whatever, but it's just not there. And to have tabs, you know, as a design go, right, so we've got to put this possessive apostrophe in. We'd rather just have just the E and the S next to each other, but we can't because that won't make sense.
Is the apostrophe in there?
It's in there, yeah. It's in the, if you look at, well, it's in both of them.
I'm looking
British,
at it now.
Of course it's going to be.
I don't see it.
Pretty sure it's there.
Oh, I do know. I mean, this could be a Mandela effect moment. I can't see an apostrophe at all.
It could be. Let's have a look live. Let's see. But I'm. No, you're right. It's not there. That's interesting. Yeah, it must be a Mandela thing because I could have sworn the apostrophe was in it, and it's not.
I'm looking at the DVD box set, series 1-4. That has an apostrophe.
The season box set does.
So what the series 1-4 box set does, yeah. The VHS from the 80s doesn't.
Well, this is it. So I think that's where we've got to be looking. Interesting. So my brain has connected. That's always the weird thing. My brain remembers as a kid seeing the apostrophe, but clearly didn't. And it must have been seeing the apostrophe as a younger adult and then that becoming fused to earlier memories, which
it wasn't.
There's
also no apostrophe on the new Blu-ray releases.
No, absolutely. I'm looking through the, going through an image search and seeing the same. Which is really, really interesting. And it makes sense to a degree. I mean, because typographically, to have that sort of weird space it would put in, I can understand why it was dropped.
Yeah.
But it does mean the title becomes a bit weirder, doesn't it?
It does a little, yeah.
Blake's Seven.
Yeah.
Yeah. Curious. Well,
yes. Anyway, so
I think that's podcast done, isn't it? Stumbled into unknown territories in the sort of 500th time, and don't know.
But that's not why we were convening today, is it? We weren't getting together to discuss Blake Seven logos. We were getting together to discuss the news of a planned reboot, certainly by Multitude Productions. Which consists of Peter Hoare, who directed some episodes of the last run of Doctor Who, Matthew Bouch, and Jason Hay-Ellery. They said they would love it to go to the BBC, where the show ran from 1978 to 1981. Peter Hoare told Deadline, "The Blake Seven story is legendary because they were given a softly slot that was intended for police drama with a budget intended for one big set and a few location shoots. At the time, it felt like it meant something. Those shows got into my veins. I could tell they didn't have money, but I was able to compartmentalize and enjoy the ride, knowing the sets wobbled. We're driven by our passions, but also seeing that there's a gap in the market in the UK, particularly with the well-publicized dropping off of Doctor Who for genre-based British IP. There's some reference, I think, I've seen to Andor as well. comparing it, that that succeeded not because of its budget, but because of the integrity, wit, and sophistication. It's probably a bit of both, to be honest with you, because Andor looks amazing. Like, the scale of it is it's very impressive.
And so was the cost.
Yes, indeed. but I mean, Blake 7 is a thing that, I mean, we've touched on Blake 7 a few times in the past, not heavily.
Yeah.
I'm not as familiar with it as you are.
Why?
Because there's a kind of a weird hole in Blake 7 for me. So I've seen the first sort of four episodes, maybe six episodes, several times.
Mm-hmm.
But because I got into it kind of comparatively late, it requires on the goodwill of my wife to spend some time watching it. Whereas the last series of Blake 7, I vaguely remember watching when it went out. But in terms of like revisiting Blake 7, I'm not that familiar with it.
I think something which always sort of slightly bugs me about the memory of Blake 7, which they bring up, and the same with Doctor Who, is the wobbly set thing. And I think it's an interesting argument they make about it having a sort of like police procedural budget, even though the budget was higher than what Doctor Who had at the time, which I think is, as I recall, I think it's one way or the other, isn't it? I think it must have been that way, right? Oh, I can't remember. My brain's gone. I always felt like in the first series that the budget was spent on the first four episodes, which certainly have a sort of sense of a higher production value than the rest. The wobbly set thing is if you think back to the police dramas at the time, everything which had internalized sets had wobbly sets.
Yeah.
None of the interior locations, especially ones which were sort of erected for, that were not established sets, had wobbly walls. You know, the doors banged and the walls, you know, wobbled.
Well, it wasn't just drama. I mean, Blue Peter and Swap Shop had wobbly things.
Well, this is it. And there is a sort of sense, I know when you're taking people outside of reality, and that's your genuine intention, that you become more aware of the lack of authenticity, the lack of reality to it. I get that. But if you watch most stuff, especially on the BBC of the day, you had a very similar quality across the board. I always feel that Blake 7 and Doctor Who sort of get a sort of unfairly picked on for it, because it was there everywhere. Yes, you could see it more in the fact they'd have spaceships which didn't quite which miniaturized in a way which didn't quite work, or magnified in a way that didn't quite work, but yeah, you none of it was great, and that's just how it was. So yeah, I suppose in the end they're trying to build on that cultural memory and trying to find ways of elevating the notion of the concept above the memories of its quality. But as I've always said, and as I think we were saying the other day, to me, the fascinating thing with Blake 7, a bit like the struggle that Star Trek has had, is in a sense, its legacy or its value almost comes from, while the aesthetic was imperfect, the aesthetic was, through production values, unique. And in a sense, you really want to try and replicate that as much as anything else. As said, in the same way that Strange New Worlds has tried in some ways to replicate the colourful and vibrant aesthetic of the 60s show with the yellow shirts and the red doors to the ship's lifts and all the colourful palette. And I think that is quite an interesting sense, because as I've said to you before, when I've known people trying to recreate Blake 7, and if you go back to the early Big Finish recreations, you have a very 21st century attempt to it, which is either looking at bio-organic or alien-esque industrial Greece as the way that a Blake 7 dystopian future would be created, in case people don't realize that is kind of what Blake 7. Blake 7 is essentially Star Trek flipped. It's where you have a great federation, as you do in Star Trek, but in the British version, especially in the cynical 70s, it's flipped into being a dystopian space which needs to be contested, and your heroes are contesting the Federation. In fact, if you look at the logo essentially is a Star Trek Federation symbol sort of on its side, skewed. Whether that's deliberate or not, I don't know. But yeah, that's what Blake Seven is. It's a dystopia, but part of its charm comes in how the aesthetic of the dystopia sort of was lifted away from your expectation of it being a dark, gritty space, which invariably I think they'd have liked, but they couldn't do. I think the second main set of the series, the ship, the Scorpio, they had, which was meant to be a rundown, they called it a planet hopper, but basically a rundown transporter. Yeah. The interior set, I think they wanted more like Alien, and they ended up getting something which was, as usual, very silver, quite bright, and slightly studio-esque, or was studio. And they were kind of frustrated by that. But in a sense, it kind of lifts and makes what is a very dark world almost a little more enjoyable to watch, because it has something interesting to see.
Yeah.
While if everything's dark and gritty, and it just becomes boring and oppressive. So, yeah, I think Blake Seven is a really interesting one to think about how you adapt that if you bring it back.
Yeah.
I suspect they won't go down the route that I think they should go down.
Which is?
Well, I mean, like, I take the Strange New World Enterprise compared to the original Enterprise. Yeah, it looks better, but invariably it is really the shapes of it are an organic mix of the one from the 80s movies and the 60s TV show. Yeah. If you look at the Chris Pine movies, the Enterprise there, I think you can get to like the shape, but the shapes are not quite as reflective of that era.
Okay.
It's a little bigger than life, as you tend to do if you redesign things. Yeah.
I think that, I mean, there's four series of Blake Seven, and the idea that, I mean, there's a lot of the charm in these things, and this Star Wars comes into this as well, because there's so much to be fascinated about looking at Star Wars purely from a visual sense, looking at the craft, the various ships, etc. Matt Irving and people like him, mostly Matt Irving, did excellent work on Blake Seven. And a lot of it's kind of largely forgotten. There's massive scope there for mining. If this is a reboot and a recreation, there's loads of scope for mining just like the civilizations and the planets that were visited in Blake Seven in a way that wasn't done in the show. So I'm kind of excited by this, if it is a thing that does transpire, if it does happen. I think that there is a lot of potential for it.
But it's, again, I think how they do it will be important. And I sense that the most successful reboots are ones which aesthetically really touch base with where they come from. And if they don't do that, I think they could be in... I think unless it really attracts a new audience, it's just invariably going to be compared to Andor.
Yeah.
And there's just no way it's going to match what Andor how it can do. So it's really got to, in a weird way, divert its audience attention to the original show rather than to Andor, even though it's trying to riff off the interest that Andor created. Yeah. I think the other danger here is that it's hard to sort of say how much of what Andor, what success was to do necessarily with the subject of Resistance, and how much of it was a very beautiful, well-paced and smart show. It's hard to know what audiences took from that. With Blake Seven, I mean, Blake Seven is slightly different, because Blake Seven is, even though some people see it as one man's fight against the Federation and his and having his crew doing that, and ever since there have been long arguments. I remember being part of Yahoo groups, you know, if you remember when those were a thing.
Yep, I do.
And there was one called Aquitar, and I was quite heavily involved in. And there was often debates over, and if you know the show, this makes sense. If you don't, that's a problem. Blake, who is the lead character, who is the one who's fighting the Federation, and his second-in-command, Avon, who is a cynical computer analyst, who eventually, slight spoilers, comes to lead the team, whether you were safer under Avon than Blake, and whether Blake wasn't actually a freedom fighter but was a manipulative man, a manipulative narrative, and how Avon is actually this great person. There's a lot of it's an interesting show into the lines, and it is relevant. I think that is the point. It is relevant. You know, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, and I think you can really play on that. But is that what this show is at its core? I mean, in the end, the show is interrogation. You know, bless him, never the most subtle man in his ideas. Mm. As the Daleks were obviously very much a latent symbolic of recent fascisms and fights against certain ideologies across the world. Blake Seven is the largest Robin Hood in space. If you were to sort of elevate a picture, you wouldn't say freedom fighting or rebellions. You'd say it's Robin Hood in space, because that's what it is. Blake is Robin. Avon is Will Scarlet. Gan is Friar Tuck.
Little John, sure.
No, Little John, sorry. Yeah. Villa's Friar Tuck. Jenna's Maid Marian. You know, it's, you can, the transposition is just blatant. Travis is the sheriff of Nottingham. Sir Valan is King John. It's an absolute typical Terry Nation mapping. And there's nothing wrong in that, because that's often where the best ideas come from, or the best revisions to create new ideas. But yeah, so again, it's like, what, where do you get it? And as soon as you go down the path of it being, you know, Robin Hood and his Merry Men, the sort of thought of the aesthetic and the sort of nature of the plateau, or sorry, the terrain of the story, becomes very different to if you're doing it as the equivalent of either, as we've said, Andor or even Westworld, you know, where there's also like an oppressiveness to the story. So I think it will be interesting where they go with it. And my memories of Blake Seven as a kid and as an adult has always been around less about the, oh God, you know, will he beat the Federation? It's been about a show of a lot of witty one-liners. Often placed because they didn't have the money to do multiple sets, so you want to keep them in the same sets as long as possible. So dialogue was massively important. Witty one-liners of a group of people on the run, and whether they were the bad guys or the good guys, largely wasn't a massive part of the show. No. I don't think it was about every week there being an adventure. I think the other fascinating thing with Blake Seven, which I'll be interested to see whether it ages or not, is Aurak. Aurak at the time was a very, as we were saying actually in the Armageddon Factor, a mobile computer in the fact it was a plastic crate with flashing lights. But essentially it was meant to be initially a computer which could link to any other computer which had a similar chip that it had, because the creator of those chips that was in every computer was the creator of this device. So it could access, surveil and interact and even control any other computer, which is, you know, is one of the most early sci-fi analogies of what would become the internet that we've seen, that you've ever seen. So when we've now got AI so much in our phones, in our computers, doing exactly what Aurak would do, which would become their expositionary device of switching on and go, you know, Aurak, tell us about this planet. Yeah. And it would be able to do so because it was tapping into other. It wasn't alive. It was, you know, technically it was as intelligent as an AI, really, I guess. How does that transpose now that that is actually commonplace? Where does that sit as a magic box? Does it still work? I guess it does, because it's a hacking device, which is what it ended up always being. But and Avon's best friend, which was always kind of fun. But yeah, I think things like that are going to be interesting. But I think the aesthetic is what will sell it. Can you create an aesthetic which speaks to what it was before, what they talk about, this cheap aesthetic, but make it feel real and big? Can you sort of, I mean, Liberator, I think, could be the Liberator still. I think maybe you do something with the struts, like the Enterprise Strange New Worlds, sort of use the sort of struts from the films and the TV show. In the TV show, they were quite just like plasticky, almost like coffee stirrers, while in the film they had a sort of more organic shape weighted for the nacelles that they carried. If you did that sort of thing with the Liberator, I don't think you need to change the design.
No.
I don't think you have to do it much at all. I think the same way that Battlestar didn't either.
Leaning into the sort of British 70s post-industrial design of the things like the Scorpio rather than the Liberator. I think I like that look more, to be honest with you. It's more in keeping with just what was going on then in terms of like you mentioned with Alien and stuff. There's the thing also of casting. I mean, obviously we don't know who's going to be casting it. I saw a mention of casting. Someone suggested casting Gisette Simon as Servalan, which I thought was quite an interesting idea.
I'd love that. I think she'd be great. I mean, she's a fantastic actor. I think she would be absolutely amazing as Servalan. Yeah. We were watching The Night Manager and just sort of saying how, you know, given that he's done, Tom Hiddleston's done Loki so well, he'd make a great Avon.
Yeah.
He could do Avon, an amazing job, different to Paul Darrow, but carrying, I mean, the radio player was Colin Salmon who played Avon, and he was fine. I think the problem with Avon, if you are, again, drawing from the source material, Paul Darrow was an incredibly good physical actor. A lot of Avon's was in the voice, but also a lot of it was in a posture of a cat-like posture in a lot of ways. I mean, while the actor was infamous for absolutely breaking every prop on the set, the character had a very sort of cat-like familiarity with props in a way that was unusual. So there's so much, I think it's the thing with adaptation where there's so much the pressure when you recreate that you've got to recreate in your own style. And I think that's a mixture of artistic integrity, maybe a little ego, maybe in a sense to try and give yourself a sense and the people who are buying this a sense that what you're doing is your thing. You know, you are buying art, not just duplicators or replicators. But I think if you're taking a property which exists as a property for specific reasons, and then you try and push them aside, that's when properties tend to not work. You've got to try and, again, with any adaptation, it's not about fidelity, it's about sort of spirit, I think. You know, there's academia has often talked about, you know, it's adaptation about how accurate you can replicate the original. But then, you know, again, what is the original? People, when they think of Snow White, they'll think of the Disney film as the original rather than the original Snow White. So, you know, that becomes very subjective. And again, what would make Blake Seven great is subjective too. But I think the thing that unifies people often is an aesthetic as to what something is. As they look back, they'll look at the aesthetic. And if you can replicate that meaningfully, I mean, like, in again, going to Strange New Worlds, their phases that they're using in this one are very similar to the 60s one, but done in a way which is less bulky. And I think that's a really clever thing. If you can update designs rather than recreate, I'd love to see those curling tong guns again. I think they are fascinating. They're what people talk about with Blake Seven. One of the things that come to mind, if you don't have them, I don't think you really are, you're not, because this is the other thing, isn't it? It's like, how confident do you seem as, because in the 90s, I think there was a problem with adaptation. In the 80s, it was often because they just didn't have the money. But in the 90s, especially like with the superhero genre, there was always a sense that, well, before Batman, I guess, and maybe Superman's a bit of an outlier to this, that there was a sort of scaredness to try and adapt a comic because it would look stupid.
Yeah.
And I think there's a fear of adapting something like Blake's. There could be a fear of adapting something like Blake Seven because it would look stupid. The curling tong guns would look stupid. But then it's like, well, they made them look real. Paul Darrow especially was very good making those guns, actually, ridiculous as they were, look like they were essential. Shatner and Nimoy and that crew were very famous for, I think it's in Shatner's memoirs, that when they had their flip communicators, you know, at the time, no one else had flip communicators. You know, obviously we see them in our phone designs now, and their intention was initially, they were going to do them, they were meant to sort of be quite delicate with them, he said. And they said, no, Shatner says, we were quite rough with them to make them, because I think him and Nimoy especially felt like they should feel like they're everyday things.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not even like personal possessions, they're just company assets.
Yeah, yeah.
It's equipment. So you treat it like equipment, you don't treat it gently. And I think those who do that with props, and I think, you know, to be fair, I think Tom Baker was very good with that with the sonic screwdriver as well. You felt it was just a piece of equipment. That's the way to sell the universe, is how do you sell that familiarity, however ludicrous it is. And I think Blake Seven needs to be slightly ludicrous in design to give it its own IP, to re-give its own IP. It's got to feel, I mean, look, I mean, and the Vogue is there. Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, Ragnarok, you know, these are big, colourful movies, you know, stepping in. I think if it steps into the alien zone, I think it's going to suffer because that is a really too, it's far too a safe space.
Well, not only that, the alien itself struggles within its own zone, doesn't it, really? We're at a point where maybe Predator's more interesting than Alien within this, within Alien's own universe. It's not, it's, well, those movies have never had the same impact that they had in 1988.
Is that when it was? Predator.
Aliens.
Oh, Aliens 86?
86, yeah, exactly.
I think it's 86.
That's how long it's been.
It's funny when people have a go at Alien Earth. And I think Alien Earth is doing exactly what it needs to do, because Alien was always about, this original show and Aliens, original films, was about getting a company, a corporate company, getting the alien back to Earth.
Yeah.
And what would it do? Yeah. So as soon as you do that, the main antagonist is the company, not the alien. And so Alien Earth is kind of playing with, you know, what is the alien in so far as creating new aliens, new different types of aggressive creatures, and the alien becomes less important. And people are going, oh, well, you know, in this show, you know, spoilers, there are, you know, the simulants, I can't think, but they're not androids. What they are in the alien world, synthetics. Are sort of overly dominant, and now, you know, one of them might control an alien, you know, they're devaluing the alien. It's like, but that's essentially what the company wanted to do. So you've got to have that sort of sense of change in that world. Otherwise, as you say, the format becomes sterile. It either becomes a replication of one of the previous films, because it's a parasite. It's a killing machine parasite that, A, to be exciting, you can't stop it. So that limits what you can do. And B, it's not really intelligent in the way that we are. So there's limitations to what it can do. So you've got to find new ways to do stuff with that. Well, with Predator, where it's an intelligent creature, an intelligent race with a culture, there's far more, as you say, there's far more space to play with that. I agree. I think it's a fascinating issue with these sort of long-running adaptations.
And think with Aliens as well, the whole Aliens Invading Earth, that was a comic strip in 1993.
Mm. Yeah, Alien,
The old Dark Horse strip. So it's not a new idea.
And books. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's always been one that's been... I think we've said this in the podcast before, I think there was a massive, massive misstep with Alien 3, which isn't Fincher's fault, to try and go back to the original rather than try and complete a trilogy.
Yeah.
And the trilogy should have ended with, as we've said before, I think, Hicks, Bishop, Newt, and Ripley on essentially what they were going to do until Ridley shut it down a few years ago, a second version of Alien 3, which should have done exactly that. And then you'd have had an arc which was less about the xenomorph and more about the company, which invariably always was about the company that was actually pushing this. And you could have finished it rather than just kind of sort of going back to the original, which was only like 10 years previous, and trying to replicate its success and just looking, unfortunately, like a weaker variant of. Yeah. So, reboots are fascinating. But I think we're in a world now where you can start to see patterns of where you have success in reboots. And it seems to nearly always be trying to be authentic to what the cultural memory is. It can be dangerous because sometimes they can turn around and go, well, what's the point? You've just redone. If you're too close, thinking about like the Psycho remake, but you know, like the Spider-Man franchise recently, or Spider-Man franchise generally, the sort of the Marvel movie success. I think DC have struggled a lot because up until the recent Superman film, they've not massively tried to go for that comic aesthetic with Superman. And even the Batman films are largely based on Burton's reimagining, you know, the big heavy tank like Batmobiles.
Yeah, they went colourful they did go colourful, didn't they? But there's still a heavy degree, I should say, of the Tim Burton stuff.
Yeah, Tim Burton introduced the armour, didn't he? The armour, I think we've said this before in the last 16 years. The armour, the lack of the the athletic, the ninja of Batman kind of disappears to the equipment of Batman, harking back maybe to the 60s shows to some degree, playing a bit with that, but reintroducing him as a realistic character who would exist as a smaller man of stature in a heavy suit, rather than being a sort of big man of stature in spandex or whatever it would be, and being his dexterity that carried him. And while there's been attempts to redo to play with some of that, no one has done kind of what they've been doing in the recent Superman film, and what Marvel's been doing for years, which is just kind of ignoring all that and just playing into that comic aesthetic. Yeah. So yeah, Blake Seven needs to play into its old aesthetic. And again, this is the interesting thing with Doctor Who, isn't it? It's like, I suppose Doctor Who's problem is that even back in its day, there were multiple aesthetics, multiple styles. So it's not, Doctor Who has a harder struggle than Blake Seven does being able to define what does Doctor Who look like, let alone what should it be like? You can see them sometimes attempt to find that. I think they've tried it a couple of times. The most recent console room, maybe to a degree. Essences in police box things, you know, when you see the designers talk about how they design those.
If you're listening to this on Patreon, you can continue and listen to the rest of the show, in which James and myself discuss the TARDIS, life on Mars, and whether Blake Seven's reboot will actually happen. But for the rest of you, it's the end of the show. Let us know what you think, as ever. If you're watching this on the Patreon, you can drop us a message underneath this. So we're always interested to hear what you think about these things. And of course, if you are listening to this through Apple Podcasts or Spotify, preferably Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review on there with a 5-star rating, preferably. And a 5-star rating will get you read out, and that will help us to reach more listeners. We'll be back soon. Look out for more 500-ish podcasts as well. Until next time, it's goodbye.